Next up with our special guests, the technology. How did they do it? We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. With you, Christopher, let's start by asking you this about clues out there that would make you so sure that these artifacts have been machined.
Sure. First of all, what I would like to say is that, you know, in today's world, we have different classes of work. You talk to a quarry person, somebody working in a quarry, and as far as tolerances on a product or a block of stone, they would work to within a quarter of an inch, maybe a little closer. That's one class of work. You get into manufacturing, and you have production operators, and they may work to within 5/1000ths of an inch, a quarter of the thickness of a thumbnail. Then that is another class of work. Then you would get into precision machining, which those machinists would work with it to within 1/1000ths of an inch, about half, less than half the thickness of a human hair. And then you get into even more precise work. Then you're talking about precision tool makers, gauge makers, opticians, and lapidary work. They work to within 10/1000ths of an inch, so a tenth of what the machinist would work to. Now, having said that, I'm setting the stage to describe what we do have in Egypt on the Giza Plateau and in other areas around Egypt, particularly in the Serapeum. And what we have are objects that show a geometry, a perfection of geometry, and a tolerance on the cut stone to within 2/10000ths of an inch.
That's incredible.
And yes, that's 1/10 the thickness of a human hair.
I'm not sure we could do that today.
Well, we can do that today. I mean, we we understand. I mean, we do it all the time. And if we had to create some of these granite blocks that are machined to such close tolerances, we could devise the equipment to do it.
Could we have done it 200 years ago?
Well, actually, the concept of precision really didn't come into play until the Industrial Revolution,
right,
in terms of these kind of geometries, flat surfaces, within 2/10000ths of an inch, that you will see on my website on that page. If you scroll down, the very bottom there shows me inside this granite box inside the Serapeum. And the toolmaker's square that I'm using has a 14-inch blade, and and is precise to within 50 millionths of an inch. And the match or the light that you would see if there was any deviation from perfection on the blocks is not there. You don't see any light coming through the interface. And not only that, if you look at the underside of the lid, you will see a reflection of my hand, and you also see a reflection of the square that I'm using. And that is indicative of a perfectly flat surface. And not only just in those places that you see me measuring them, but also across the entire length of the box. Now, when we look at this and we say, this was quarried as a single piece and cored out of a single block, and then finished off to that kind of precision, something's going on here that is not consistent with what we're being told about the purpose for these things. We would not perform that kind of work for just simple purposes. Number one, the concept of precision, as I said, didn't come into bear until the Industrial Revolution. And that was only because we found a need for it. We found a need to reduce the variables in the processes to create more precise artifacts. In fact, if you go back to the Civil War, they started to realize that they needed to reduce the variables in the manufacturing process because they didn't want their soldiers modifying the spare parts that were going out into the field because
right.
they were having to file them down to make them fit. And so if you go back into our recent history and you see what kind of work was being performed then, and then you go into Egypt and you see these artifacts that are more indicative of modern precision, that's why I say is that the high tech is there, it is cut into the stone, it is certainly secondary evidence or circumstantial evidence, but it is not possible to create these with anything but very, very precise instruments.
Okay.
And we're not even talking about how they lifted these blocks.
Right, that's another issue.
That's a totally other issue. That lid weighs over 20 tons.
And you believe, though, some catastrophe wiped them out, Christopher?
I believe that that's the case. I believe the evidence is in the geological record, the biological record, to show that there was indeed a huge catastrophe.
Could it have been nuclear, that they blew themselves up in some kind of battle or war?
Well, I wrote about that in my book, and I'm not really convinced that that is the real answer. I think there are numerous possibilities. I'm not really stuck on one. I mean, just recently, last year, they discovered this crater in southern Egypt, and the crater was only visible from space, and it was 19 miles in diameter. Now, we don't know what the age of that, that meteor strike is, but certainly that does really put a different light on
sure
the
does.
Catastrophism.
Sure does. Michel Barsoom, let's go back to you again, being an expert in ceramics and your theory of partial concrete in the rest block stone. They did polish it up, right? They polished the pyramid up on the sides with some kind of liquid-type limestone, didn't they? Didn't they make it smooth?
Well, that's what is called the outer casing.
Right.
Okay. I mean, in other words, the pyramids now, they, except for the second pyramid that has a little bit of its casing still at the very top.
So I think almost everyone will accept the theory that occurred, right?
Well, no, actually, no. The Egyptologists do not concede even that point.
Right. They don't say that it was like a smooth, nice...
Oh, no. Yes, it was smooth. Yeah. Yeah. No, what I'm saying is that outer smooth stone was cast.
Oh, I agree. And then so what? Some of the Egyptologists say that there was no casting done at all?
At all, yeah.
I see. Get into the science of the casting for a moment, if you could.
Okay. Yeah, I can... It turns out that it's a very simple formula in retrospect. What I think they did is they started with something called diatomaceous earth.
Okay.
Which is, you can go buy it for your pool filter.
It's that white stuff, that real
yeah,
powdery
exactly,
stuff.
Right.
Okay.
That's the stuff, right? And it's basically amorphous silica or amorphous sand.
Okay.
Okay. So you, that's one ingredient. So what you need is water. You add lime to the water.
All right.
Okay, and then you add your diatomaceous earth. And the high pH of the lime, basically it's an alkali solution.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does, it dissolves that very fine diatomaceous earth. And then you dump in your limestone rubble. And then you wait a few days. The water evaporates. And this is from Davidovits' idea.
So the rubble is to give it more mass, I guess?
Well, no, actually the rubble is the main ingredient. It's like concrete.
Okay.
Know, like the concrete, you have both the cement, the Portland cement.
And little stones and stuff.
The aggregate, essentially.
Okay, I'm with you.
So the limestone is the aggregate in this case. And then you let the water evaporate for a few days, and you end up with a mud, kind of a dryish mud.
All right.
And then you make a bucket brigade. And you pass the mud, again, this is Davidovits' work, and you pass it along from one person to the other.
All the way.
All the way to the very top. And then you cast it in a wooden mold, and you tamp it down. And there you go.
Well, not to the top. They start on the bottom first, right?
Well, yeah, no, yeah, yeah, of course, right.
And so they do the perimeter. They just keep going up.
Yeah, well, the exact details I do not. I haven't really thought about it. I just want to say one
right.
point about why it would be very difficult to cast the whole thing, and that came out of our study. Basically, what made the water alkaline is lime, and to make lime from limestone, you need to go to 900 degrees C. And that's a very high temperature for a primitive society. If you're going to just burn wood, it's not easy to get 900 degrees C. And one of the valid criticisms to Joseph Davidovits' theory was that there were not enough trees in Africa, and I'm exaggerating now, to make enough lime to make enough cement. And this is part of the fact. And if you go to this hybrid model, then in other words, for them, in my opinion, it was more expensive, quote unquote, expensive to cast than to actually carve and haul up.
All right. And Margaret Morris, why do you believe the entire structure was cast?
First of all, as I say, the evidence for block quarrying does not exist at Giza to support the Great Pyramid. The quarry would have to be many times larger to support the Great Pyramid. I go into quite a bit of detail.
I mean, are there any quarries in Egypt, even if they're hundreds of miles away?
There's one other Nummulitic limestone quarry in Middle Egypt. You would have to ferry all those blocks from afar, and you would have to leave good limestone at the foot of the pyramid and all over Giza untouched. It doesn't make sense. But what we propose is that in the beginning of the Egyptian civilization, when they were building their first towns, they had to do massive deforestation. They had to get rid of that wood cover so they could get away from the wild animals and start to farm. And we think that in the early dynasties, they had a lot of wood. They burned it, they made lime with it, and even lime from cooking pots, if it were saved and given over to the government for...
Yeah, we don't have that evidence, Margie, because... That may be true of other blocks, but from the blocks we looked at, there was no sodium and no potassium.
Okay, well, all I can say is that we have to get more samples, but everything we see, for instance, Dr. Salk said that when he went to Giza and he looked at it with his naked eye, it looks like limestone. The reason for this is because geopolymerization produces such tiny cement particles that they cannot be seen with the naked eye. You have to have a scanning electron microscope to even see them. So the limestone is going to look natural. And, of course, you know that we've had a problem for 20 years that Egyptology has not been open to any alternative ideas about the pyramids, so we were denied samples.
Right.
So what we did to overcome this was to go out in the field and look for telltale blocks. For instance, we have a photograph of a block on Khafre's pyramid, and it's got just a huge cobble in it.
If you were able to analyze a block, you'd probably know right away, wouldn't you?
Well, sometimes you don't have to analyze. Sometimes you can just look, because sometimes there are telltale features.
Yeah.
I'm talking about a block that I've shown to limestone geologists, and they all say, well, this is impossible within the natural formation.
Well, aren't there some fossils in some of the blocks?
Yes.
How'd they get there?
Well, first of all, the rubble from the Giza quarry is a Nummulitic limestone. It's full of these fossil shells they can be up to the size of a quarter. That stuff was gathered up and it was converted into concrete. So when you go to Giza and you inspect the quarries, what you largely see is normal sedimentary layering where the little fossils look like coins.
They were just mixed in, you're saying?
Yeah, they're just flat. Where the little animals died, they just lie flat. But when you go to the pyramids and the monuments, not the Sphinx, because the Sphinx is just a leftover from excavating the concrete grade limestone. But when you look at the monuments that are masonry blocks, what you find is that the shells are all scrambled up, as they would be in any kind of concrete. There are only very few, I think we've found two areas at Giza where the cells are not all jumbled up, and those two areas are places where it is known that they took advantage of the natural bedrock in order to save themselves labor when they built it.
Interesting. Now, Christopher, in your book, The Giza Power Plant, you talk about a Coral Castle and Edward Leete Skolnin. And a couple of years ago, Richard C. Hoagland went down to Homestead, Florida, to do his own investigation there. I found that interesting that you would mention him in that book.
Yeah, and the reason I did that is, obviously, it's, Coral Castle is not in Egypt, and it's not related to the ancient Egyptians. But the reason I included it in the book was that when it comes to analyzing or theorizing about how the ancient Egyptians lifted stone, we have lots of candidates who are, you know, on television, on documentaries, theorizing this and that. And Ed Leete Skolnin seemed to me to be the only person who actually demonstrated it. He stated specifically that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built. And then this 100-pound man soaking wet was able to lift into place 30-ton rocks of stone.
Exactly. I mean, it's very puzzling. And
so that's a huge mystery. And, you know, I don't know that nobody knows the answer.
Now, he was an expert in magnetics, and he was an expert in sounds. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's a tie-in there.
Well, I think so. I think he had something. Can I prove it? No. I mean, it's just a hunch. But then a lot of us work off of hunches. But I think that he definitely had something, and he was able to demonstrate it. And I don't know why he would say that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built, because I think to know that, you would have to go back in time to the time when they were being built. But that's what he stated.
In spite of everybody's theory, and let me very quickly just ask real quickly of the four of you, starting with you, Christopher. Regardless of your theory, are you baffled?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Regardless of my theory, it's definitely, I would put my theory aside to know the truth. I mean, this is not an ego thing for me. I am a seeker of truth, and I think that, you know, that all theories should be entertained, or at least some of the more reasonable ones. But I think it's a huge question mark, and until we answer it, it's that we're missing a lot from our heritage. The ancient Egyptian heritage is missing a lot. And that needs to be restored, I think, the status in the world.
Robert Schock, how about you? You baffled?
Yeah, I'm definitely baffled. I think that's what keeps bringing people back to Egypt and back to the Giza pyramids in particular. We don't know everything. I would like to interject, if I could, very quickly. I think one of the real problems, from my point of view as a geologist, is our inability to sample so far. I mean, I think that we could solve a lot of these questions pretty easily if one was given free rein to...
I agree. There's for some reason, Zahi Hawass, who has the power to let everybody in, all of you, at one time, as a matter of fact, he won't do it, and I don't understand why. We'll talk about that. We've got a break coming up. Let's talk a little bit about why you all believe Zahi is holding back. I mean, there's something strange going on here, and Robert, like I said, we're going to work on a program with you and the Sphinx. I also think, with your permission, if we get somebody from Edgar Cayce's foundation just to talk a little bit about what Edgar said and then tie that into your scientific investigation, I think the two of you will find out that there could be something very incredible here. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Christopher Dunn, Michel Barsoum, Robert Schock, and Margaret Morris. At the top of the hour, we'll keep two of them for your phone calls. I tell you, our four guests tonight, great information. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about Zahi Hawass and why they believe that he's holding back. And then, you know, why do we really need to find out how the pyramids were built? Why? We'll find out about that, too. We'll go around the table, beginning with you, Margaret Morris. Why do you think Zahi Hawass, who heads up antiquities there in Egypt, just doesn't let all of you in there to finish the job?
I think that he's following standard protocol, which is that since the days of Eric von Daniken and other and Ville Hakowski, archaeology and Egyptology have been very resistant to anything alternative about the pyramids, especially. Some of the theories get wilder every year, so they just shun it. And if Zahi Hawass understood that he could have his capstone he dreams of, and that he could have monument restoration. Zahi just doesn't know the facts. You see, Zahi, when Michelle released his study, Zahi thought that Michelle had accidentally taken some modern concrete restoration off the Great Pyramid. And so this shows that after 20 years, Zahi still doesn't understand the nature of a geopolymeric rock. He doesn't understand that it is real rock. It's a similar geosynthesis went on to produce 55% of the Earth's crust. So he doesn't understand this high-quality, sophisticated concrete. If he did, he would embrace this technology. I think that with 20 years of good science and Michelle's energy and 4.5 years of research, that Egyptology really is on the verge of accepting this and embracing it and using it to keep monuments from falling apart.
Michelle, how about you? Why do you think Zahi is holding back?
That's a good question. I think part of it may be not invented here. I also think that it's part of his character in terms of control.
Is he afraid that we will say that the Egyptians didn't do this?
I would think more that it somehow takes away from the monument, if you will. You know, if you can show that, I mean, you know, what would you rather have? You know, a concrete floor or a piece of granite? And I think, I don't know. I mean, I really don't quite understand it.
It is a puzzle.
Maybe you should invite him into your program.
Yeah, I think we should.
And ask him that question.
We should. How about you, Robert, your take?
I think Zahi, I don't think we want to underestimate his intelligence or his savvy. I mean, he is an Egyptian politician when it comes right down to it, and he's very, very knowledgeable, very savvy when it comes to Egyptian politics. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that he has a very high government official minister, or close to a ministry, and it really has a lot to do with politics, and he's got many things to juggle at the moment, and he doesn't particularly, I believe, he probably does not want to open up certain cans of worms, which could backfire on him.
Jeopardize his career,
that type of thing, and I've had many conversations with him, both publicly and privately, and I'm not going to divulge private comments.
I understand. Do you like him as a person?
I do like him as a person. I also, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but I'll use the term, I also fear him as a person in the sense that he's a very powerful, very charismatic person.
Oh, yeah.
And one has to be, I think, hold him in high respect. And, you know, he's a very complex person.
And lastly, you, Christopher, why?
Well, I agree with Robert and Margie on their assessment of it. I would like to add, too, and Dr. Barsoom could agree or disagree, but I think that there has been a history in Egypt of outsiders coming in and tearing off with their relics. They end up in museums across the world. And I believe they're very sensitive to that. Now, the modern-day archaeologist or researcher shown that they would go in and try and rip the heritage of Egypt away from the Egyptians and assign it to Atlanteans or the aliens or other cultures, and I believe they're very sensitive about that. So I think there, you know, there's a lot of sensitivity about what has happened in the past and what they fear may happen if the door is thrown open for just anybody to go in there and start digging and develop theories. And they like to control. He likes to control information that is released. I've personally met Zahi on three occasions, and like Robert said, he's very charismatic, a very powerful man.
Well, I mean, I want, when we were watching him on the Fox television special, remember years ago when they yes. sent the little camera down that that tunnel? Mm-hmm. I mean, he made you think that we were going to find all kinds of great things on the other side. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a good motivator. I mean, he's exciting to listen to.
He's done a lot, including people like Robert Schock and John West and Graham Hancock. He's done a lot for tourism in Egypt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Margaret, in the Baalbek, Lebanon, there's a 1,000-plus ton structure, 72 feet long. They call it the monolith. This slab is, I think, the known largest piece of, you know, rock on the face of the earth. Did they pour that? How did that get there?
I think you're going to find that this technology spread around the world, and one of our goals is to find out where and to follow that trail. But I can tell you that there were larger monuments than that in ancient Egypt. The largest one that I know of that was reported in history, it doesn't exist anymore, but Pliny reported a 5,000-ton monolithic temple all the way up north in the delta at a little town of Buto. And he measured it himself, and he knew that it was monolithic. And when his measurements were analyzed by Egyptologist John Wilkinson estimated that the temple would weigh 5,000 tons, and that is based on the average weight, the average density of granite. And of course, today we cannot duplicate the feat of taking a 5,000-ton monolith from Aswan to Buto. The closest thing that has been done in modern times was in 1996. Some engineers said it would be impossible to move a lighthouse in North Carolina to keep it away from the Atlantic Ocean that was about to take it under, and they had to do enormous technology, and they did manage to move it on a level track for a half a mile. Compare putting the same weight on a barge and moving it both overland and hundreds of miles along the Nile on a barge in ancient Egypt. We know a lot about ancient Egyptian ships. They were not strong enough. And there's no canal at Giza for getting a weight like that out. There's no dry dock. We can't say, but the most logical solution is that thing was made by the bucketful.
All right, let's go around the table. You know, we've talked about the theories on how you think this was built. Let's talk about the why it was built. Starting with you, Christopher, of course, you believe it was basically a power plant. How would it work? What did it generate?
Well, the power plant theory actually analyzes all the evidence within the Great Pyramid. The theory finds answers for those features. And essentially what we have is a structure that is coupled in a resonant fashion with the earth and vibrates in sympathy with the earth. It's probably the prime purpose for it before the Great Pyramid, the other pyramids, when they were built, was to relieve the plates, the earthquake. Earthquakes. And there has been some research done by the Russians where if you drive or cause vibration in a shaft filled with water, they set off explosions. They can cause those plates to actually move. And there's also been some speculation, though I'm not sure if anything's been done in the United States, but there's been speculation that if you set off a series of very, very small earthquakes, you could, instead of the pressure building up to a huge release,
huge one, right.
Then you could release that energy over time. So essentially, that is basically where the energy comes from.
Was it strategically placed where it is, Christopher, or was that just random?
No, I don't think anything was random with the building of the structures
okay.
in Egypt. Nothing was random. And, I think that everything was planned ahead of time. And with all due respect to Robert, I do believe that the Great Pyramid was planned completely and constructed at one time. But that's, we all have...
You all have your own
ideas
theories.
And theories, right?
And that's what makes this an exciting show. Robert... Why was it built?
Well, as I was saying before, I think there's a number of reasons, but I would say that the overarching reason was what we might term nowadays as religious or sacred. That was really a sacred structure, which doesn't preclude other things as a subcategories. For instance, astronomical observations, I think, were taken from the Great Pyramid. A lot of work has shown that it clearly has astronomical alignments, seems to fit into a larger complex at Giza. Also, tying in with what Chris Dunn was just saying, it may have in part been a response to catastrophes. And to my way of thinking, a lot of religious impulses actually tie in with nature and what's seen in the natural world, including catastrophic events. I talk about this in some of my work, including extraterrestrial catastrophes such as cometary events,
mm-hmm.
asteroids, bolides, that type of thing. And Chris was just mentioning earthquakes that might tie in also. But I see it as primarily a religious type of structure.
Okay, how about you, Michelle?
I'm not qualified to answer that question. I don't know. I mean, the only thing I know is...
Maybe just a tourist attraction. I go back and forth
right.
between L.A. and St. Louis. They've got this huge arch there. Other than a tourist attraction, I don't think it serves much of a purpose. Unless
one wants to play croquet. Yeah, the only thing I could tell you is, in this particular case, I'll have to defer to the expert.
Okay, and how about you, Margaret, then?
I think that it suits the model that Egyptology has really refined, and therefore it was built by the Heliopolitan priests who were astronomers. They were very highly skilled in astronomy, and it did serve a religious sacred purpose, as Dr. Schock points out. It was... Well, Henry Breasted, back in the early century, last century, developed the model of the primordial mountain, which was in mythology the first place to rise at the beginning of the earth. And the mythology held that the sun god lighted on the tip, let out as a sacred benben bird, which the Greeks called the phoenix, let out a cry that spun all of nature into motion, including the heavens, and that this represented the soul of the king, and that the pyramids were the dissension point, the king's soul ascended from the upper chamber of the pyramid, and the belief in ancient Egypt, too, was that the king's soul could return in times of national emergency and use the tomb as his base of operation. This was a spiritual belief. You find it throughout ancient Egyptian literature. So the pyramids fit with this model. They're in the necropolis, which is the place of tombs. They have sarcophagus in them. Each one has a sarcophagus in them. Usually we find that they were unused, so they could have been there for ritual purposes. But I think that to say that the pyramids are tombs is to reduce the idea down to the most simple, and it becomes so simple that it it doesn't work. It was more complex.
Isn't it amazing, though, Margaret, here we are, whether these were built 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, or even farther back, we're still perplexed by this. We're still puzzled exactly how they were built, how they were moved, what they're there for. It's amazing, isn't it?
I think that we could get to exactly how they were built if we got cooperation. We've done all of this at our own expense on our own time for 20 years. Michelle volunteers his time. Every scientist who has been involved in this volunteers his time because there's no actual grant money and there's no permission to really study. So this is why it takes a lifetime, and we'll probably be at it for another 20 years.
Isn't this one of the last wonders of the world?
It was the first wonder. It was proclaimed by the Greeks to be the first and foremost wonder of the ancient world.
And it's still there.
And it's still there because it's built in such a solid way. And the reason it's so solid is because the tiers are level. And this speaks to the kind of precision that you can only get with concrete construction.
It is amazing.
From a materials point of view, to me, the pyramids are child's play compared to what they could do with hard stone. That just with supposedly copper is from a material scientist's point of view, borders on the impossible. If you look at the outer casing in the Menkara pyramid, the third pyramid, there's a granite, outer casing there. And the precision and the way that these things were cut is like they were cutting cardboard. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it truly is. What happened to them, as Christopher says, perhaps a calamity, as Robert talks about. I wonder what happened to them. Something tragic occurred a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. I have to also say here that it's not that difficult to lose technology. It happens all the time, in Egyptian ancient history.
Could the pyramids be 50,000 years old?
I don't know.
Who wants to jump in on that?
I do.
All right.
There was a mortar dating test that was done, and the dates didn't vary more than 400 years from the Fourth Dynasty, and that deviation can be accounted for because of the way the mortar was made. Had lime in it, they didn't know that, and so they had lime pollution in their tests. So according to the mortar dating tests and the slight variation, the Great Pyramid is Fourth Dynasty.
I read somewhere that they did the carbon dating on the boat that was buried. And that it was 900 years before the pyramid.
We think so that they may have preserved those boats with wood preservation techniques, and that if they geopolymerize those boats, which you can do with wood, by the way, you can soak it and kind of petrify it.
But I'm talking about the carbon dating of it.
Okay, well, all of you just stay on hold because Tommy will get to all of you. I'm going to keep two of you for phone calls, and then the rest, the other two of you, thank you so very much for being on Coast to Coast. All your websites are located, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. So we'll be back with two of our guests. I want to thank right now, of course, Michelle Barsoom, Christopher Dunn, Margaret Morris, and Robert Schock. Two of them will stay with us. We'll take phone calls next hour for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need to email me about anything, well, all you simply have to do is go to george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back in just a moment with two of our guests remaining, four came in to go out, and your phone calls.